The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay, welcome back. One quick announcement before we get started. Teaching fellows and I have... In response to a few gentle inquiries, have come up with a plan for making your problem sets and projects a little bit easier, getting you some time. Take a look at the website and talk to your teaching fellows. But basically, there will be no problem set 6. It will be combined with problem set 5. And so you'll have a full 3 weeks to work on your project, tripling your project time, assuming you haven't done anything so far, which hopefully all of you have done a lot so far. Okay. So, we were correlating absolute levels of messenger RNA abundance in protein, messenger RNA protein. And here this study was subjected to a little bit of not terribly controversial critique. What you're seeing here is if you have the very low abundance proteins, you might have what looks like some correlation. Then you add a few more low abundance proteins, so this is just some fluctuation. And adding proteins should improve your correlation coefficient, but if they're of low reliability in either the protein or the messenger RNA scale, or if there isn't correlation between the two for biological reasons, then your correlation coefficient could drop just at random. But as you get up to adding all the proteins, you could either be dominated by a few high abundance proteins that fit this perfectly, the messenger RNA protein abundance. Anyway, some of the critiques of this had to do with the assumptions underlying the Pearson linear correlation coefficient, which in calculating the statistical significance of some of these analyses in the previous slide, make an underlying assumption that you have a normal or Gaussian bell curve. And you don't need to do this in order to, there are a variety of measures of correlation which do not require this parametric assumption. And there are tests for how close the normal distribution is. Deviations from normality can be of all types. For example, you can have slightly flatter or slightly sharper than normal. You can have skewed to the left or to the right, and so forth. Some of these, like skewing, can be corrected by a log transformation, where you simply take the logarithm or some other transformation, and log being by far the most common and theoretically justified, and now it becomes normal. And then you can do a statistical test. As it turns out, this is not a huge effect, but they use it in order to develop, to point out that you can, when you're testing these, especially the low abundance end of the spectrum, you might want to use a rank test. And a rank test here is illustrated that you take, if you have, say, two columns, this is a series of pairs of intensities of messenger RNA and protein, say, columns X and column Y. Down in the lower right-hand corner of slide 37. And let's say the abundances, the absolute abundances for protein X is 1,666, and corresponding RNA Y, which would be 8, 2, 3, and 4. Now you want to ask whether they're correlated or not. And what you do is you rank them. And so the rank of X is 1,333. Here, a tiebreaker, the way you deal with a tie is you give them all the rank of the middle one of the series in the tie. And you get a rank for Y. And the total number in this case is 4. And so when you have these, the rank test's score is basically the sum of the square of all the differences in rank. So the difference in rank here would be 1 minus 4. Be three squared, and you take the sum of all those squares and you plug it in as this S, which is going to go into a correlation coefficient similar to in values and in properties to the Pearson, but now not making assumptions about the parametrics. You're just talking about ranks. It's a non-parametric test. And then the n is the total number, and you apply that formula. Now, they applied that formula to this exactly the same data set, or very similar, actually, data set. So another critique they had was that using the better measure of the protein abundance would be using a radioactive tracer in the protein and then measuring quantitatively the intensity of beta particles released from the methionines in the proteins. So they making that change and comparing it to the same messenger RNA assessment, they got this fairly linear correlation over three logs. Using the Pearson correlation coefficient, which they didn't entirely approve of, they got a 0.76, which is a modest, it's a significant linear trend. And using their rank method, 0.74, which is basically very similar, and found no significant difference between the top 33 and the bottom 33 proteins, undermining the previous claim that there was less linearity at one end than another. You might a priori expect that the least abundant messenger RNAs and proteins would have a little bit of either biological or instrumental noise. Nevertheless, this group found that it was a good correlation. Now, these two plot, the plot in the next slide, looks similar, but it's really quite different. Here, the y-axis remains the protein abundance measured by this S35 labeling, but now we're getting back to this game of asking, to what extent can we make predictions about the properties of the proteins, in this case their abundance, based on their use of abundant codons? And a way of quantitating this is the adaptation index, shown in the lower left part of the slide, is you have it's the log of the codon adaptation index is a sum of all the frequencies, F sub I, of each of the codons, where I is the 61 non-stop codons out of the 64 total. And the W sub I is a weighting factor where it's the ratio of the frequency of codon I, let's say a leucine codon. There are six different leucine codons, and the first one, the W sub 1, is going to be the ratio of the frequency of that first codon to whichever one happens to be the most abundant one. Could be the first one, or it could be one of the other six. And so that's the formula that is used. And you can see, again, a nice linear trend where, indeed, the most abundant proteins do tend to use the most abundant codons. The codons that you find in, that are most abundant, both at transfer RNA level and in usage in abundant proteins. Now, just as with RNAs, you can measure them on an absolute scale or a ratio scale. The advantage of, in principle, if you have it on an absolute scale, you can always calculate ratios from it, but not necessarily vice versa. You have ratios, you can't always get to absolute. So that's one advantage to absolute. If you're looking at things like codon adaptation index, or messenger RNA, or a variety of other motivations for you need to do it on the absolute scale. But there an argument can be made for doing it on a ratiometric or relative scale in the sense that you can establish internal standards which are more precise. You can really eliminate many of the systematic errors that can creep in due to differential ionization in the case of mass spectrometry and so on. Now, with RNA, the way we did this ratio testing, ratio quantitation, is we would label one messenger RNA red or Cy5 and the other one green, and then by using selective filtration in the imaging, you could get ratios. With mass spectrometry, you don't have colors, but somehow you want to get the same idea across. And so what you do is you have masses. And so what you want to do is encode them in something that will not change the chemistry, but will change the mass. Not change the mass too much, because if you change too much, you might change the chemistry, or you might not be able to find the shadow peak, the second peak. So basically what we're doing is we have what we want to do is take cell state 1, label it with the light ICAT reagent, cell state 2, label it with a heavy, meaning more neutrons in it, and then mix them together as early as possible. And then all these steps that could have little systematic errors in it will be, the errors will be equally distributed to each of the peptides that have been labeled, and then measure the mass. And for each mass, you'll have two peaks that are separated by whatever the difference in mass between the labeling agents. So what are the properties that you want of a labeling agent? One is that it should react covalently, so it will survive all these mass, these fractionation steps and mass detection steps. So it has to be, in this case, style specific. You want a way of pulling out only those peptides that have been modified. All the rest are just going to contaminate your mass spectrometry. And in between, you want something where you can differentially label heavy or light atoms. In the original proof of concept, these were done with hydrogen atoms versus deuterium. They differ by one atomic mass unit per position. However, you will see in the next slide, this has the unfortunate consequence that hydrogen and deuterium actually are not only mass distinguishable, but they also have different chemical properties. There's an isotope effect that's detectable in a variety of chemistries, including retention time on the HPLC. This has since been upgraded to where you're having C13 versus C12. Now, that's a much more subtle difference, same mass difference. You have 9 different carbon atoms in here, and that works better. In addition, there's a way that you can cleave off the biotin after it's done its job, where you've, with avidin, you've selected all those peptides that have been modified, and then acid cleave off that to clean up the mass spec. So here's an example where you have the difference in M over Z of 4 M over Z units between these heavy and light peaks, and the ratio of these two is something you can use for essentially every peptide where the pair of peaks is in an uncluttered part of the mass spectrum. And here's evidence where you can see that on retention time, in the horizontal axis on the left-hand side of the slide, 41, you can see this little red line shows how the centroids of the set of peaks should line up, and has been displaced through the chemical effects of that, adding a few neutrons. Okay. So the lesson here is that hydrogen and deuterium are not necessarily chemically identical. The conceit of isotopes is that they really should be chemically identical, but not. But really, it's better if you work with heavier atoms to introduce neutrons. Now, so what can we do with this ratiometric assay? Now we're going to, just like before, we compared absolute protein levels to absolute RNA levels. Now we're going to measure ratios. And to do ratios, we have to have two different conditions. Another advantage of absolutes, you can do it all under one condition. Here, the two conditions that were chosen for this proof of concept experiment were glucose and galactose. That is to say, growing at plus and minus galactose. Galactose is a nicely understood metabolic and regulatory system in yeast. It fits in with what we know about the central carbon metabolism, and induces a set of genes in blue here that are required for galactose catabolism to produce energy. The most strongly ones are way off in the upper right-hand corner here, Gal7, 10, and 1. These are the core catabolic enzymes. But almost all of the named blue triangles have some kind of story like that. And these all in the upper right quadrants have a high log 10 ratio of expression up to 3 logs 10 to the third fold induction. Similarly, or at the other end of the spectrum, in the lower left-hand quadrant, are respiratory genes that are involved in
say oxidative phosphorylation, and these are moderately depressed under galactose conditions, and that's why they're in the lower right hand corner. And then the green ones are not quite along this diagonal. Their messenger RNA is increased, but their protein expression is not. And these are the ribosomal protein genes. And this is another phenomenon that's well documented in the system. Okay. Now those are examples of how you can use absolute and why you're motivated to use absolute and relative measures for proteins and messenger RNAs. Now, these are all treating as if, just like before, I said that messenger RNAs, we might lump all together all splice forms and call that the gene product, although you know better. And the same thing with proteins, you might lump together all the protein splice forms. And not only that, but for a particular protein splice form, there are many different post-synthetic modifications, such as proteolysis and phosphorylation. And so we're going to talk about these modifications very briefly to hopefully whet your appetite for one of the most exciting parts of proteomics, and whether it's identification or quantitation. So we've already mentioned radioisotopic labeling as a way of quantitating using various radioactive sulfur. You can use, whether it's stable isotopes or radioactive isotopes, you can use these to do pulse labeling to monitor a dynamic process. P32 is, if you want to enrich for the some of the most well-studied and significant post-synthetic modifications involved in signal transduction. You can enrich for particular types of amino acids. We already showed that the cysteines, which is kind of an arbitrary amino acid chosen for the ICAT ratiometric method, that was chosen because it has interesting reactivity, not because it's intrinsically important low abundance regulatory molecules. Phosphates, on the other hand, can be very important, and you might need to enrich because these important regulatory phosphorylation sites can get lost in the snow of all the rest of the peptides in the proteome. This enrichment can either be done by immobilized metals, such as iron and gallium and so forth. This is called IMAC, for immobilized metal affinity chromatography. Or you can have antibodies that are specific particular phosphopeptide, particular phosphoamino acids. You have lectins for carbohydrates as front ends for mass spectrometry. Even when we do P32 labeling metabolically, where the P32 will only label the subset of the proteins which are phosphorylated, it is still the case that some of the most interesting regulatory cell cycle proteins are not detected above background, because there are many abundant proteins, such as ribosomal proteins, central carbon metabolic enzymes, which are needed in high abundance, but are also need to have phosphorylation. And so you get this forest of phosphoproteins, such as ribosomal and metabolic, which make it hard to detect the regulatory ones. So labeling is not a panacea. And we'll come. I think you'll see as we go through the protein modifications in mass spectrometry that the multidimensional purification really is the way that you get away from the ribosomal proteins and the highly abundant metabolic proteins, which are interesting, but you need a way of both studying them and the regulatory low-level proteins. Here are some examples of natural crosslinks. You can think of this as a special class of post-synthetic modification. Instead of having a phosphate glomming on, you have two different peptides, either intramolecularly within a protein or intermolecularly between proteins. And you should be highly motivated to study these, because they tell you something not only about protein structure, three-dimensional structure, which was the topic last time, but protein-protein interactions. And not just theoretically what proteins might interact with other proteins, or, you know, or might bind in vitro, could be an in vitro artifact, or in yeast, in a two-hybrid system, could be a yeast-two-hybrid artifact. these are actual covalent, caught in the act, in vivo protein interactions. And some of these are, you know, most of these are very well documented. By far the most common one and of great significance to protein tertiary stability in the class of proteins which are extracellular. These include extracellular domains of membrane proteins and secreted proteins and in particular because there the oxidation state is such that this sulfur-sulfur bond is stable, while intracellularly it tends to be more reducing atmosphere, and so that these disulfides have trouble forming. Collagen has a lysine cross-link. Ubiquitin has a C-terminus to lysine cross-link. Fibrin, involved in blood clotting, has a glutamine to lysine, and so on. Some of your proteins age, you will find the glucose that's in high concentrations in your blood will glycolate the lysine residues, and this is part of the process by which these proteins are eventually lose their function and are cleared. Protein nucleic acid interactions we've been talking about so far are non-covalent. Some of them are covalent. For example, when you want to prime de novo polymer synthesis, DNA synthesis. Okay, so what are the consequences for the mass spec algorithms we've been talking about? Say de novo sequencing or finding a peptide spectrum in your database. Well, you can see the masses are going to be fairly straightforward. Here's some examples of masses and some peptides and some cross-linked peptides. On the top right, you'll see one intramolecular cross-link between a lysine and a lysine, and an intermolecular between two peptides. Now, each of these peptides in this display, these are just simple masses. These are not fragments. These are not subfragments. So you expect these to just be triptych products. So each of their C-terminals should be either arginine R or lysine K, R, K, K, R, and so forth. And so you can see this is two peptides, one ending in R, one ending in K. So let's look in detail at this example where you have an intramolecular crosslink, and you can see that as you cleave at each of these peptide bonds, generating B ions from the N-terminus and Y ions from the C-terminus, you'll see that there's a special case in the region that's defined between the two crosslinks, in that any peptide bond cleavage that might occur in the gas phase when colliding with argon or some other inert gas will break the chain as usual, but the chain won't fall apart because it's got actually two connections. One is through the normal peptide bond and the other is through this cross-link. So cleavage is all through in here. It takes two hits to get separation of these, and two hits is unlikely. And so you'll tend to see the B ions and the Y ions up until you hit the first cross-link amino acid, and then you lose it. So that's one of the complications that you have from cross-links. The other one that you have when you have, say, cross-linking two peptides, as might occur when you have an interaction between derivative proteins, is you'll now have two sets of B ions and two sets of Y ions, as if just having B and Y in the same spectrum isn't enough. Now you've got two of each. And even though you don't have this cycle to worry about, you have a full set. But there is an algorithm that Tim Chen and others have developed for dealing with that in very clean cases. And here's an example of actually using the cross-links that you get from mass spectrometry as a fairly inexpensive set of constraints that you can use for getting distances either intramolecularly in this case or conceivably intermolecularly. And the constraints, you can't get any bigger than the cross-link distance. You know the chemical structure of the cross-linker, and so you can say these two amino acids with their side chains and so forth, they're reacting, have to be this length or shorter. And that's what these little yellow lines indicate in this fibroblast growth factor 2, FGF2, where the crystal structure of FGF2 is known. And these constraints will greatly aid your ability to find distant homologs or to increase the precision of your homologously modeling in three dimensions. The shorter your cross-link, obviously the better, the tighter your constraints, but it might reduce the efficiency of cross-linking if you're doing this as artificial cross-linking as opposed to if you have a natural cross-linking, you're basically stuck with whatever the natural. This was an artificial cross-linking with a chemical cross-linker, bifunctional cross-linker. As just a reminder, this is a different way of showing some of the things. We had a scatter plot last class, which showed that as you increase the sequence identity in homology modeling up to 100% on the vertical axis, you decrease your uncertainty and the observed root mean squared deviation that you get between two structures. So if they're better than 80%, then you have in the order of one angstrom deviation, which is quite acceptable for many purposes. Now, if you want to do threading to very distantly related structures, you know, getting down around 30% is getting, 25% is getting to the twilight zone where you really can't believe it. It's off by too many angstroms. But these constraints in the previous slide could help you out in either doing the homology modeling or doing a threading where you're searching through your favorite sequence through a database of three-dimensional structures to ask which three-dimensional structure is closest to. Now that FGF2 we had two slides back with all those constraints can be run through this threading algorithm where you run the sequence through the database illustrated here. This is horizontal, you know, the various rows of different structures here. The fold family is in the second column from the left. The sequence identity of our search sequence, which is FGF2, against all these three-dimensional structures, the percent identity here, 98.6, is basically, that's the same structure. That's the trivial example. Its threading rank is number one, as it should be, since it's exactly the same structure, almost exactly the same structure. The constraint error, of course, is going to be zero, because all the three-dimensional structure and all the cross-links work to that structure. But an interesting one now, this has been ranked by the constraint error, not by the threading rank. So you can ask, does this improve the hits? And the next one down is FGF2 compared to IL-1 data. And they do have the same fold family. We know that from three-dimensional structure. And the percent identity is way below the usual cutoff where you can't infer from threading or sequencing. In fact, the threading rank is 5, which is not the second best thread. But the constraint error is 0, and so if you combine the good threading rank and the constraint error, then you would put this as your best distant homolog, 12% to 13% sequence identity. And of course, it's beating out better threading ranks because it has fewer constraint errors. So you can see how powerful these constraints might be, and it's certainly, you just need to evaluate exactly how cost-effective the mass spectrometry is. Now, the last topic today, sort of in the realm of protein modifications and interactions, are how we quantitate metabolites. Now, you can see that we've got some momentum here on quantitating proteins and RNAs. And so what are the issues that are slightly different from metabolites? In slide 52, summarizes some of these. You have, when you break open a cell to isolate messenger RNA or proteins, there is the rate at which degradative enzymes act is on the order of, seconds. That's the rate at which they go. While many of other metabolic processes take on the order of milliseconds to microseconds, very rapid kinetics, and so as the cell starts to get a little bit sick on the second range, all these enzymes are scrambling the metabolites concentrations. So you have these rapid changes. The detection methods are historically idiosyncratic. They might be enzyme linked where you'll have, in order to detect a metabolite, you have a series of enzymes that result in some fluorescent or luminescent assay. Or they could be gas chromatography, liquid chromatography, NMR, mass spectrometry, and so forth. The good news is there are usually fewer metabolites than there are RNAs and proteins. There could be 30,000 some RNAs and proteins, typically only 1,000 or so metabolites, even in the more exotic, the metabolically enabled, such as E. coli. Here, from their various databases, EcoSci, WIT, CAG, and so on, which integrate these information about metabolites with the enzymes that act upon them. Here, we're just looking at the kind of the sort of mass range that we have. Typical mass range, they're very small compared to proteins and RNAs, most of them being around 200 atomic mass units, and many of them having absolutely identical mass, that is to say they have atom for atom exactly the same composition, even though it's arranged in three dimensions very differently. For example, isoleucine and leucine, as their names might imply, have exactly the same mass no matter how many significant digits you put on them. And this is illustrated by actual data on isoleucine and leucine. These are supposedly highly purified versions commercially available of isoleucine and leucine mixed together here and run out in these two dimensions of mass on the horizontal axis and retention time and hydrophobic separation, now not of peptides but of amino acids, metabolites. And you can see how that even though they are identical in mass, as shown on the previous slide, around 131, they are separable in the by their hydrophobicity. They have the same atomic composition, but they are separable just by this hydrophobic separation. And you can see in the commercial preps, there are a variety of contaminating molecules that co-migrate in the reverse phase dimension, presumably because something like reverse phase is used for purifying them commercially. So there are basically three ways of distinguishing molecules that have the same mass. The one in the previous slide was separating them by another property, like retention time on hydrophobic properties. Another one is secondary fragmentation. Just as we could fragment peptides by collision in a gas phase with some inert gas, we can do this with metabolites. And so two things that have the same mass may have a different fragmentation pattern. And you can see, again, you can cleave at every particular position, and here are two different aspects from two different labs, slightly different methodology, showing fragmentation in almost every carbon bond. The third method by which you can distinguish compounds that have exactly the same mass. In this case, this is the most extreme case. These compounds have the same mass. They actually not only have the same chemical composition, same atomic composition, they actually have the same chemical structure. Their three dimensions are the same. Their mass is the same. What it is this. Let's say the red is a carbon 13 and the green are the carbon 12. You can have the carbon 13 in different positions on this, say, this glucose molecule. So it has the same three-dimensional structure, the same mass. It's just you move the position of the C13 to different positions. This is actually an interesting case. When you have natural abundance glucose, where you have C13 trace amounts, it can be positioned on various different carbon atoms. But you can still tell where it is by when it is now not broken down in the gas phase by collision-induced dissociation, but it's broken down in the cell. It goes through different pathways. And this is an example that we're going to be talking about pathways nonstop for the next three sessions. But here's an example of central carbon metabolism where you start with glucose 6-phosphate in the upper left-hand corner of this network diagram, and you end up with carbon dioxide down in the lower left. And it can go through various pathways through ribulose or down through free carbons. And each of these 3 and 2 carbon breakdown products can have the labeled atom, the mass tagged atom, in different positions. And as this quote from the literature points out, that when you want to study the fluxes through the pathway, by monitor, you can actually do a pulse or a stable, steady state labeling with isotopic labels, and you can monitor the fluxes through these pathways, but you need to take into account all the different ways that you can go through the pathways, especially when you're doing metabolic cycles, like the TCA cycle, or you have to think think through all the multiple turns. Now, in principle, that kind of metabolic tracing can be done either with mass spectrometry or with nuclear magnetic resonance. When you do quantitative 2D nuclear magnetic resonance, you're basically looking at the shifts in the spectral quantities for the carbon-13s, remember we were talking about carbon-13 labeling, and the normal, most abundant protons. The chemical shifts here that you get are due to the exact chemical environment of this proton or this carbon-13 for, say, the alpha for each of these amino acids, alphas and betas. And each of these little clusters are schematic for the intensity of this particular these particular atoms that you're monitoring by their isotope effects on the NMR. Here, the odd number of nucleons is critical to the detection. Okay, so if you know the structure of the network, then you can use that knowledge, and you know which of these atoms go into which parts, then you can use this to quantitate the fluxes through any point in the network. On the other hand, if you only know part of the network, then you can use this way as a tracking to slowly piece together how the network must go. Most of this was worked out well before genomics and our current systems biology methods, and so there aren't real algorithms for doing this as far as I know, although there certainly is an opportunity for doing it. Now this is measuring, remember this, ratios versus absolute amounts. This is measuring not only ratios of metabolite concentrations, this is not metabolite concentrations, but fluxes. So with metabolites, you can measure concentrations or fluxes, absolute or ratios, all four of those combinations. Now let's say, in principle, if you can measure absolute concentrations, you can measure ratios, and you can measure ratios of fluxes. So how would you measure absolute concentrations? So remember we said that one of the problems was that as soon as you start perturbing the cell, in microseconds, you can get changes. Well, one way to do this is without lysing the cells, you can snap freeze them, or expose them to aqueous methanol at minus 40. You can wash them at that as a liquid, and you can remove the outside metabolites, and there's reason to believe this is the minimally perturbing method of preparing the cells, and then you put them in basically boiling alcohol. And then quantitate with NMR methods such as the ones we just talked about, getting up to 1,300 measures per sample. Some examples of some of these internal metabolite concentrations. Now remember, these are not flux ratios, but actual metabolite concentrations of things like glucose-6-phosphate, ATP, pyruvate, so on, can be correlated to genomics by the vehicle of gene knockouts. So we have wild type on the top of the far left, followed by a deletion of HO. This is a homing endonuclease, should have no metabolic consequences at all. This is used as a control. It's a pseudo wild type. This shows that the deletion method itself is not changing things, the metabolism. And then as you go further and further down this list, you get more and more severe expected effects on the ability of the organism, say, to produce energy, as exemplified by its ATP production. Now, if you have low ATP production, that means you have high residual levels of ADP, which is the other end of the energy spectrum. And so if you look down these columns, it's a little hard to see with all the clutter that's produced by the standard deviations. I wouldn't want them to get rid of those standard deviations. It's wonderful. But anyway, you can summarize this by looking at the ATP to ADP ratio. That's a way of, you don't need ratios for this to work, but it's a way of accentuating this energy balance. And so you can see for wild type, you have about almost 7 is the ratio of ATP to ADP, highly charged in this high energy state. And as you get to these PET mutants, which are mutations in the mitochondrial process, you find the cell is becoming increasingly ineffective. Now, these were all chosen because these were so-called silent mutations. The title of this paper says that you can get phenotypes by looking at the molecular analysis, quantitating the full, holistically, systematically, all the metabolites for things that otherwise have no phenotypes. Okay. Now, this representation, as you start quantitating full proteomes, proteome interactions, proteome modifications, metabolites and their interactions, you start wanting to relay this information, summarize this information in the context of models. And just as last time, the upper left-hand portion of this summary, I emphasize that no model is exact. Sometimes the people working in the field convince themselves that it's more exact than lower models, but every one of these, even the quantum mechanics, is a poor approximation of electrodynamics, and molecular mechanics has only spherical atoms represented. Some of the most challenging cell models involve Master's equation of stochastic. Now we're not talking about single atoms anymore, we're talking about single molecules. Still, it's too coarse for many experiments. You can have phenomenological rates, such as the ones we've been talking about, represented in ordinary differential equations. How do you get the parameters that describe now concentration and time, not single molecules, but sort of treating them as a bag of, you know, a particular part of the cell or the whole cell having a particular concentration of molecules? And then we'll go on as we get into the network analysis. In the next three lectures, we'll talk about some of these other models which have their rules. But let's just get at how would we get some of the parameters that describe concentration and time. And when we talk about the formalism of these networks, regulatory networks mainly are about binding, but they intimately connect with catalytic networks where you not only bind, but you actually change the covalent structure of molecules. And the simplest such case, single substrate going in, single product coming out, is at the top of this slide number 60. And here you can see that the enzyme E is typically a protein, but there are, you know, RNA catalysts and so on. But the property that's emphasized here is that the enzyme is not consumed. As A goes in, it makes a covalent change from EA to EB. B is released. E is recycled. E is not consumed by this cycle, but A is consumed. B is produced. But let's look at it in a different light. In a particularly interesting class of reactions, for example, those involving regulatory cascades, signal transduction, enzyme modifications, here the enzyme now becomes substrate. The ATP is now no longer consumed in the whole cycle. ATP comes in, modifies the enzyme to a phosphoenzyme, accompanying reaction regenerates the ATP, turns the ADP back into ATP. So the ATP, in a certain sense, is catalytic here, and now the enzyme is consumed, producing a phosphoenzyme. So it all depends on when you start constructing these graphs. What is the node? Whether the node is a substrate or the node is an enzyme depends on how you look at it. And I do this, you know, somewhat provocatively, so you'll think about these networks not just as binding, but as catalysis, and not just the enzyme being the catalyst, but sometimes the substrate as well. Now, this is the simplest case of measuring kinetics. This is not equilibrium. This is kinetics. And we're studying this plot on the far left-hand side of slide 61. Substrate increases, the rate of production of product increases. You can start out with zero product or small amounts. And it used to be, historically, at the bottom, you would require, to do the experiment, you would require that the product be as close to zero as possible. You do initial rates, and you have this simple relationship where the increase in product was a simple function of the 1 over 1 plus reciprocal of the substrate concentration. And this, as as the substrate would increase, you'd eventually saturate the amount of enzyme that you have present in the experiment, and that would be the maximum velocity for that amount of enzyme, or Vmax. However, if you have a more full equation where you take into account all the players, at least in the simplest system, the forward velocity, dpdt, the derivative of the product concentration at the respective time, this might be in moles per liter, it's going to go up with as the substrate goes up. More substrate means it'll go faster in the forward direction towards product. But if you have some product, you'll have some product inhibition. You'll have a tendency to the kinetics to go the opposite direction. So this is negative as a negative component with product. The Ks and Kp are sometimes called Michaelis constants. As the substrate gets closer to the Michaelis constant, this is basically related to the binding affinity for the substrate, and that's a natural sort of halfway point where the substrate is half saturating is roughly what the Ks is all about. Now, let's compare this very simple case. We have one substrate producing one product to a more typical case where you might have two substrates producing two products. And let's take this out of a real network, and we're going to show this real network in just a moment in its all its glory. Here you have two substrates, ATP and F6P, going to two products, ADP and FDP. And you've got this same sort of form where you have a velocity of this reaction, and it's a function of the reactants, F6P and ATP. And you find them in the numerator here. And you find these Michaelis constants in the right places. But in addition, you find in the denominator this curious term that has these fourth powers. Well, we didn't see any fourth powers in the previous slide. Why are we getting fourth powers? It's because, and why is AMP in here? It's not even one of the reactants or the products. What's going on? Well, this is actually a regulatory phenomenon, allosteric, where you have a second site on the enzyme. One site does the catalytic magic, and the other one is regulated by some infinite wisdom of the whole network, is an important feedback. So AMP is related to ADP as a further step, and it feeds back on this enzyme, as does F6P and ATP and so forth. So all these, and this fourth power just says you want it to be cooperative. You want to have a nonlinear regulation. So that's what's going on in this term. And it doesn't occur in the whole network, we'll show in the next slide, but it does occur at some key points like this one where the enzyme has two sites, catalytic and regulatory. And when you see these terms that are greater than linear, like the fourth power, that's sometimes referred to as the Hill coefficient and refers to the kind of the steepness of the instead of having this kind of curve, you have this kind of sigmoid curve, and the steepness of that is related to that power. Now let's look, if you compare, so this little piece, this phosphofructokinase step is going to be put in context of the entire network in the red blood cell, human red blood cell, right here in the upper left quadrant of the circle. And this is the simplest, this is the simplest metabolic network that you'll be talking about. This mostly involves covalent transitions or pumping across membranes. It treats the whole cell as a kind of a uniform bag, except with the membrane being a separate compartment. And there are really two objectives of this. One is to produce ATP so that you can run the pumps to keep the osmotic pressure constant across the red blood cell membrane so that it maintains its shape. And the other is to maintain the redox at the right level so you have a reducing atmosphere, the hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is in intimate contact with oxygen, and so there is a certain low level of oxidation of the iron rather than just binding to the iron to make methemoglobin, which is not a good physiological state. So you want to have this reducing potential to get it back to the correct oxidation state so it will bind oxygen. So you have a little bit of purine metabolism here, quite a bit of metabolism, simple glycolysis, not oxidative phosphorylation, just glycolysis produced reducing potential and a little ATP. And these 40 or so enzymatic reactions can be modeled with about 200 parameters. All these 200 parameters have been measured accurately by purifying each of the metabolites and enzymes, and this has been reduced to an ordinary differential equation model that has been evolving since the 70s. If we look at the slide 64, at this phosphofructokinase, we have the same form that we had a couple of slides back. Here's the fourth power term in the denominator, having AMP as a regulatory molecule, and then you have the Michaelis constants and so forth explicitly stated here in the numerator for the substrates F6P and ATP. And you have a similar equation for every single enzyme step in this in that whole network in the red blood cell model. And in green are the concentrations at any given time point. This can be their dynamic or steady state. At any given time point, you'll have green for the metabolic concentrations and red for the fluxes indicated by the enzyme names. And you can run this as a simulation for the red blood cell and see all the interesting questions about robustness and optimality and so forth. This is even though this is a very mature model, there still is lots to be done even in this very simplest system. Now we're going to go on to more complicated systems in the next three lectures on networks. But for today, we've basically tried to integrate the protein, either absolute or ratios, with RNA measurements and with metabolite interactions, protein post-synthetic modifications. So until next time, thank you very much.